I have also been told to be very brief, so I will be very brief because there's plenty to cover. I would just like to say I'm introducing Norm Conti. Norm is the one who set up this entire program, the Inside Out program at the prison. He's been working on it for years and years and years. He's a professor of sociology at Duquesne University, and he... I'm sure he'll mention this to you, too, but I just don't want it to pass over in silence. He, in addition to the stuff he does with Inside Out Think Tank and with teaching Inside Out classes, he is currently training, part of the training program for all Pittsburgh police recruits who come now, starting this year, are coming through Inside Out. They're going into the prison, and they're meeting with the incarcerated people and going through a curriculum with them to talk about social justice and community policing issues. And Norm set this up, pushed for it for years, and finally made it happen starting last year. So hopefully this will be he'll be able to work that in some way into his talk. Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Is the thing there? Okay, so I wasn't really sure what I was going to do today. And I brought something to read, and I'm dyslexic, so we'll see how that goes. I really am. But someone said this was a progressive place, and the piece I brought today is part of a larger piece, and the subtitle is Progressive. So I think I'm supposed to read that today. And it's about, if you remember, in about this time of year in 2009, three Pittsburgh police officers were killed by white supremacists in Stanton Heights. This thing I'm going to read to you is a little bit about my work with one of the parents of those men and how that relates to what we're doing in the prison. I'm going to read you that, and then this series started with Khalifa, right? Michelle came and talked to you. That's Khalifa's daughter. And we've lost Khalifa just before Christmas, and I have a video I'm going to play you of Khalifa. So first I'm going to read you this, and then we'll watch the video. All right, and we'll talk. And if we need to go long, I'll stick around and talk outside. This is called Progressive. I was happy to speak with those nice people, parents of the good cop, but they were not happy with me. The nice man who reminded me of my Uncle Ange called me Mr. Conti in a tense voice. Mr. Conti, my wife and I have been talking, and we don't want our son's name associated with your event. Your event, but it wasn't supposed to be my event. My agenda, but not my event. It was his son's event, wasn't it? No? For the nice man, our excellent young man, that's Leon Ford. I talk about him in this piece, the young man who was shot by the police and paralyzed, and someone else we worked closely with. And that year I was scheduling an event sort of in honor of both of them that would have the chief of police and Leon and the Shulos, which are the parents of the good cop. For the nice man, our excellent young man was a threat. Our excellent young man and his supporters are against the police. For him, some of those supporters are against everything. From his perspective, an event with the names of both the beloved good cop and our excellent young man was not going to be about common ground. It would be an attack on the police, brothers and sisters to his son, a good cop. He could not have his son's name, his own name, associated with something like that. He just knew the media would twist it into something that would hurt all of the surviving cops, his adopted children. I reassured him it would be no such thing. Pleaded a case based on love and common sense. Explained that I'd spent 17 years with, for, and near the police. 17 years of reading and writing and field work, and writing, and data, and writing, and revising, and rewriting, and rejection, and revision, and analysis, collaborating, friendship, and caring. Don't they see? Can't they see? Don't they get it? I had gone to the award lunch the year before, met them and their son's friend, listened to their stories, saw their tears, and how the nice man put his arm around his wife to comfort her. Powerful stuff, all too much. I had come directly from prison, spent the morning with my friends and colleagues, a think tank that included six men serving time doing life with me. Later, along with those guys, I would participate in a writing workshop brought to us by a kind-faced woman from a prison play. Though held in a concentration camp, her prison was something more. You could see that in her eyes. The kind-faced woman handed out a piece to all of the men sitting at the table. Its author took a bunch of stuff from his life and assigned numbers to all of it. Number of this, number of that. Seems simple, but it was something more. She asked us to write a piece like that of our own, like the numbers thing. Rarely one to pass up an opportunity to show off, I wrote this, that, and one third. Number of big dumb fans in this room. One. There's one big dumb fan in this room. I know because I almost tripped over the damn thing when I was making room for one of my friends. Number of mission statements posted on the wall in this room. One. Number of times that mission statement is printed out in English. Two. En Española, dos. With full force and proper direction, could the big dumb fan blow that mission statement off the wall? What do you think the chances of that might be? 50-50, maybe? What are the chances it could blow all of those words around like autumn leaves? Number of fire alarms in this room, one. Number of clocks in this room, one. Number of panic buttons, one. Number of ventilator shafts, too small for a grown man to crawl through in this room, one. Number of TV, DVD, VCRs on mobile carts in this room, two. Number of computers in this room, three. Number of computers that are actually plugged in this room, zero. Number of individual tables in this room, eight. Number of tables made from other tables united in this room, one. Number of windows in this room, two. One inside and one outside. Number of cabinets filled with read-to-your-child program supplies, one. Number of boxes of Spanish books in this room, one, that I know of. But what do I know about this room? I wonder if that big dumb fan, the fan that looks like a wind machine from old movies back before CGI, I wonder if that big dumb fan could blow all the words from those Spanish books into that one mission statement. What are the chances that all of those linguistic options could form their own mission statement? What if that big dumb fan used boxed up old text to write a mission statement that would change everything? I'm talking about some Jerry Maguire mission statement stuff. Ten Commandments, jumping out of a burning bush. But not commandments, a mission statement, as holy text, transforming all who read it, Babel 17 style. Problem is, it would be en Española, and I wouldn't be able to read it. Maybe someone would translate. The revolution starts right here, thanks to the sharpened blades of that big dumb fan that almost knocked me down. The pen and the sword, all in one, mighty fine. Number of no smoking signs in this room, one. Quit smoking, Khalifa. You know that stuff ain't no good for a young man like yourself. Lungs may still be developing. But what if that lit cigarette is a burning bush for our magical mission statement to jump out of? The magical mystery tour is coming to take you away, coming to take you away. I guess Khalifa can keep smoking, but not in this room, because he might start a fire. Number of friends in this room, seven. Number of times odd in this room, every time. Number of times odd in this room, all the time. Number of chants in this room, on par with the national debt. Number of people I admire in this room, oh my, maybe I'm just a big dumb fan. I was happy to write about Khalifa, maybe even wanted to make him feel good. Of course, he read his piece first and looked directly at me as he listed the number of organizations he had been proud to be a member of as two. The NAACP, and the Elsinore Bennu Think Tank for Restorative Justice. The second, a group we founded together. We would argue sometimes, but I was always humbled by his presence. So 2 years later, when he died suddenly, I wrote, Busa Emancipation Statue. Oh man, Khalifa fooled him good this time. Outfoxed them and Lamman just past the horizon among that vanguard that can only be seen by the most righteous of freedom fighters. You thought he was dead, didn't you? You did. Well, take a minute and think like Khalifa. Is your mind free? Free indeed? Well then, did you see a body? Even if you had, you know that brother could hold his breath all God blessed day just out of spite. Pardon my taking the Lord's name in vain, but I am not yet the holy man that Khalifa was to become. But on the real, you know, keeping it 100, that stuff was a conspiracy he'd been laying out for years. At the center of it, just him and the ancestors, sorting it out in their rap sessions. I mean, what do you think they were talking about? plotting. That's what they were doing. Khalifa did all he could to wise us up on that tip, but we weren't quite at his level and couldn't peep what he was saying. When he caught that life sentence, he said, "Shoot, they don't know me. If they think they can keep me in here for life, one way or another, I mean, if they don't want to let me out, I'm going to have to escape." And escape he did. D.O.C. you later. Right in plain sight. Hep C, liver cancer, 2 heart attacks. That was just his flair for the dramatic. You know how Khalifa always was. Then they think he's dead. Shoot, that's what he wanted them to think. He'd been planning it for years. Probably started when he saw that movie about the guy digging his way out of a prison with a teeny tiny hammer that he was supposed to be carving chess pieces with. Guy was playing chess with the institution as his board, but Khalifa don't play, so his moves were beyond the game. The guy in the movie was smuggling little bits of dirt in the cuffs of his pants and dropping them at yard time. Mr. Diggs flipped all that and started moving little bits of himself out of the prison. Letters, visits, dialogues, lectures, and initiatives in the hearts of his beloved and unwitting accomplices. He loved us, but couldn't risk giving away the details. Learned to be cagey in all those foster homes, detention centers, jails, and prisons. Used us like marks. The way that cop from the old days, the one with the pearl-handled pistols and extra-long billy club, used him to sell dope. He moved product for that cowboy, then moved himself as product through us. He said he's gone crazy and come back so many times that he started carrying breadcrumbs in his pocket to mark the path. Maybe that was where he got the idea, then told us that story as a wink to let us know what he was up to. Took me until the funeral to start getting hip. The urn got me suspicious. How could anyone really know for sure if that was him in there? Now, mean, not physically the biggest guy, but there was so much to him that I had to be skeptical. Then we drove up to SCI Albion, the most recent plantation of his transfer. Our group walked in, and right there at the gate on this cart, like the ones at Home Depot, all of Khalifa's belongings. A footlocker, a bunch of cardboard boxes with his name and inmate number sealed with packing tape, and one dictionary peeking out of a handle hole. One of the boxes even had his inmate photo ID picture on it. Suckers were supposed to see that as a coincidence, even though he died weeks earlier, and his stuff just happened to be waiting to greet us at the gate. Uh-huh. Coming to meet in his honor with the new think tank he had helped to form, the New Destiny Think Tank for Restorative Justice. That name seemed like a contradiction to me. Destiny is destiny. How can it be new? The group he formed with us is the Elsinore Benyu Think Tank for Restorative Justice. Elsinore Benyu, now that's a strong name. Haunted castle from the European literary canon, combined with the Egyptian precursor to the Phoenix, burning up and rising again. But that was the hookup, you dig? Albion is the haunted castle where Khalifa was finally able to catch fire and rise into a new destiny. Malachi will miss him, his sly sense of humor the most, probably because he was the only one smart enough to get in on the joke. When we were first trying to think of a logo symbol for our think tank, Khalifa talked about a statue of a slave with broken chains that might be down there in Cuba or somewhere nearby. I bet that's where he'll be waiting for us once we figure it all out. That's Khalifa, if you want to play the video now. This is Khalifa. Khalifa was about 65 when he died. This is him 20 years prior to that, when he was about the age that Elaine and I are now. So I'll show you a picture of the whole group at the end, but...
Okay, man, we're going anytime you want to go.
Okay. My name is Richard Khalifa. And maybe, you know, 41 cent, 36 cent. I'm included in myself, you know.
Okay, man, we're going anytime you want to go.
Okay. My name is Richard Khalifa Diggs. Khalifa being an attribute that I adopted in 1977 down in Allegheny County Jail. I'm in for a homicide, double homicide, in fact. And I've been down 19 years, 6 months, and 7 days as of this morning. This is my workplace. It's the operations building here at SCIP, newly constructed or renovated. However, about 8 years ago, I worked in the same building, and I always somehow was like drawn to this particular spot here, this window. It's got pretty much a full view of the yard, pretty much a view of the institution overall. And I guess I'm drawn to this because in a lot of instances, I see a lot of me in like 3 or 4 generations of my growing passing, just running around playing handball, bocce ball, tag, lifting iron, playing cards, platting heads. I mean, it's a ball of confusion to me, really, you know, and it's almost like a senseless maze of a bunch of confused people, of which I'm included in myself, you know. It's almost horrible to the extent that you sit here and you realize that, you know, you're very much a part of this. You know, you walk around and you be here after a while and you see guys, you meet guys, you get to know guys. Guys come and go. A lot of them come back for what, in my belief, since I'm a lifer, I feel to be like some real senseless, meaningless charges and crimes, you know. It's ironic to me that a guy will go out after doing 7 years from here, or 5 years from here, or for that matter, 1 year from here, where he's worked for maybe, you know, 41 cent, 36 cent an hour, and he won't go home and take a minimum wage paying job and deal with it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I talk to a lot of guys because it's painful to me. I've met so many and I've seen so many. They come back for petty stuff, you know.
We're moving.
As I said, the petty things, you know, things that I, from my personal standpoint, you know, I've learned the depth of what I miss, like the simple things, you know, just being able to go out, go down the street, or just walk out and see a park or some grass, or just to see some kids playing, which I hear is pretty dangerous now for kids to be playing. And that to me is somewhat like, you know, it's a cultural shock to me, even though I guess I'm seeing the results of that culture down here in this institution. I can't really mentally picture how it's so unsafe in your own yard anymore, in your own porch. I don't know. I'll be trying to talk to the kids in here a lot and try to understand like what it is that they think they're accomplishing, what they out to prove, and to whom are they trying to prove it to. I mean, running by in cars at 40 miles an hour, just, you know, throwing bullets up on somebody's porch, you know, claiming that they had somebody in defense of some colors, in defense of some territory, some space. And then I see these same guys down here, and man, we barely got shoulder space, you know what I mean? And for the most part, they come through and they go to talking with each other, and the very same guys that they might have been clashing with, even though, you know, they don't really get into no serious clashes here. It's like you may see them playing on the basketball court on the same teams. You know, I don't know if you can call that a generation gap. It seems like a mental gap to me, a communications gap. I don't know if you could blame it on politics, you blame it on education, you blame it on poverty. Probably all three got a huge part to play in it. But nonetheless, I still can't see where they're not being taught to love themselves, at least at home. I mean, my upbringing was no different probably than millions of men across the nation here, you know. I just never thought in terms of disrespecting my parents. I never thought in terms of disrespecting my sister, or for that matter, my friend's sister. And I'm truly, truly, like, as a father, I'm shocked. I'm almost befuddled mentally in trying to understand where they're coming from, because I don't want my son or my son's son or any of my daughter's children to have to go through what I'm going through now. And what I mean by that is, like, You know, it's not so much a physical torment type thing. It's not like I'm being beaten and choked and gagged and I got to drag a 80-pound ball of metal into the chow hall with me or up to school with me when I go or to work with me when I go. It's not like I got to go through a whole bunch of barbed wire and gauntlet type experiences or situations to go from one point of the jail to the other. More so to me, it's the mental thing. It's the trying to maintain some sense of awareness of myself and my obligation. As I said earlier, my name is Khalifa, and that attribute, which I accepted and really gave to myself down the county jail in 1977, was because of its meaning. At that particular time, I thought it was more or less an Arabic name. But since then, I've done a considerable amount of reading and studying of different cultures and religions, and I come to understand that Khalifa, an African from Abidjan, West Africa, who I drove some time ago. He was a traveling salesman. At any rate, the name means strong, protective community leader, and provider. And I thought that that would do me some good to accept that name, to accept the title, accept the responsibilities to go with that, because I knew in coming to jail for a life sentence, I would have to be all those things and make some addition to it in order to survive it. I look back sometimes in retrospect and I see a whole lot of myself and a lot of these guys down here because, you know, you walk past them and, you know, they swinging their shoulders and, you know, they strutting, I guess, you know what I mean? And they got all the outer, you know, examples or demonstrations of like, you know, this ain't bothering me, this ain't nothing, you know. But, you know, I've been here quite some time, and throughout the course of the time, I hear a lot of these same guys, you know, I mean, literally crying tears in their cells at night, you know. I see a lot of these guys getting off the phones and screaming, and I mean, like, you know, cursing whomever it was they was talking to on the phone because of a lack of understanding of their personal, you know, immediate need right now that's unable to be answered because of the situation that they put themselves in. You know, it's not like, you know, any of these men, I don't think if they were to be honest with you, me, or for that matter, most importantly, themselves, can say that this is not bothering them. If it's not bothering them, then this is the wrong place for them. They probably belong in some hospital of some sort, because they have to understand, they have to feel the restrictions of confinement. It not only restricts you as a human being in terms of your potential accomplishments and whatever you might set out to do, and with all honesty, there's a bunch of talent in this jail, but it also, it corrals and it does something to you psychologically, because, I mean, after all, it's an abnormal environment, so to speak. I mean, you're 24/7 with a bunch of different men, I mean, constant men, men of all types of persuasion, so to speak, and all the, let's say, ills of society that you think you might, you know, not be exposed to in the penitentiary, they're very much here with you, too. You know, because these are the ills of society, so to speak, that society seeks to separate from the rest of the community. But you look in their faces, man, that's where you can really see it at. When you look in their eyes and they're trying to tell you a story, whether it's con, whether it's about the girlfriend, a relationship and marriage, or whether it's about themselves, you look in their eyes, you see that, like, you know, it's kind of like a faint thing of hope. You don't know whether they lost hope, whether they're trying to hold on to hope. You don't know whether they're feeding themselves some type of story or lie to stroke their ego or to keep themselves going. But you see the distance in it. And that's what I look for when I talk to men. You know, you see the distance in their eyes, and the distance can almost give you the weight of their words. And a lot of their words are so vague because it's like stagnant. You're stagnant in life. You know, you function from bell to bell, and you evolve around concrete and steel, and it's like metal draws something from your soul or your spirit. It stunts your growth, you know. I really do wish, I would hope, that something positive would come of our attempt here this morning. I hope that something positive would come of some of the community workers out there and different organizations to really, you know, put into action the fact that it takes a community to raise a child, or that, you know, they want to better our education system, you know, and that they want to produce the kids with, you know, a higher self-esteem, which can only be done by giving them some creative things to do and allowing them to creatively, you know, be themselves and grow and be productive. The restraints, I think, that they put on teenagers is to a great extent, you know, like, ridiculous, because it's not like they're not letting them grow. Time is going on, and, you know, things have changed, technology has moved up, and like, you have to understand that these kids are more innovative than perhaps we were in our days and coming up. But the fact that they're still our kids, and they represent our future, and without them, I don't see nothing but destruction, period. If we think we can go on without our youth, you know, there's something wrong with us as adults. That we do something productive and we really reach to them to listen to them and quit telling them so much every time, because we haven't got the map on, like, you know, correctness in life and all the things that you should do, you know. All the things that we should do sometimes stifle that we can do. And not necessarily all that we wish to do is going to be correct, but there's something to be learned from even negative things, provided they don't hurt or disrespect somebody else's property or person, you know. I wish if it were possible that I could actually, you know, like, give my life right now this morning to save some of these kids that are thinking that, you know, selling dope and sporting jewelry and making babies, you know, in 13 different homes is really slick. If I thought that just giving my life really would change their minds and give them a different view and a positive, constructive path tonight, dealing with being a man and responsibilities, I would do so, because I got children, I got grandchildren, and I just got a lot of kids that I love, period, that I've met even here in the visiting room over the years, you know. And they deserve a chance, and I don't know, I don't think that there's much of a chance for them if they're not provided with the right choices and the right instruments at which to work at those choices. And I know they're there. I know, I've heard, I've done some research and reading. I know that they have available in schools today options and choices and access to counselors and stuff that we didn't have when I was coming up. So my plea and my request and my challenge to you youth out there today, that, you know, you slick in your con, you down in your game, you on top of your Mac or whatever it is you want to call it, you know, then Mac the counselor. Mac the counselor for some viable means to accomplish what you set out to do in life that is productive, that can be somewhat at least permanent for you, like an education, like a degree, like, you know, be a real estate broker or be a lawyer even, you know what I mean? Just be someone productive and respectful in the community, and then turn around and pull some other kid up that would like to be something better than his peers is pressuring him otherwise to be. And that's my message.
Can you tell?
I'm going to stop it there. If you're interested, I can send you a link to that video. I'll put it up on YouTube if you want it, whatever you want. These are the guys. That's Khalifa down there in the corner with the hat on, 20 years later. Next to him. Is that 4 years ago? Yeah, it might be. So that's him, and next to him seated, that's Robert Farouk Weidman, John Edgar Weidman's brother. The book Brothers and Keepers is about him. Directly behind him, that's Fly. Next to him is Sean. Behind Khalifa is Malachi. You've heard a lot about Malachi. And all the way at the end, that's Oscar, or Big O. You heard Amber. Some of you heard Amber, his sister. So that's Khalifa, and it's interesting. What a life sentence is a form of social death. Any kind of incarceration really is a temporary social death. Slavery is a social death. What happens when a dear friend of yours dies when they've already been socially dead for 42 years? I'm not sure. Maybe we'll just have questions now. Yeah.
I have a comment. I thought it was really stunning that he said he would give his life if he could instill in some of the young people the things that they needed. I mean, and that's really, I think, a stunning statement, especially coming on Easter.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yep.
There's something about that.
That is, I heard him say that one time in person before I saw this video, and we do a lot of work with young African-American men and women, and these are amazing leaders in their communities, right? And they're trying to change things, but it's racist for us to believe that the established politicians and leaders in the African-American community are any better than the ones in the white community, right? They're not. They are interested primarily in maintaining, not all of them, but a lot, are interested in maintaining their own position and their own power. And they try to keep these young, vibrant, amazing future leaders and current leaders from getting up to where they are because they want to hold on to what they have. They want to be able to get the grant money, right? So I would spend oftentimes Thursday nights with those people and then go to be with the think tank on Friday morning.
That's Leon Ford
and the group of men around him.
Yeah,
yeah, they're young. They're in their 20s. The things these people do are amazing. And I would sometimes, you know, be on the verge of tears in these experiences. Like, my friend Khalifa would give his life to try to elevate what you're doing. And these men, mostly men, and there's probably women too, but they will not even give a degree of their comfort to help these people. So, I told you, Khalifa, when the video didn't play, that's because Khalifa's haunting me because he's mad at me for a couple things I've done since he died. Elaine knows what they are. But, because I'm working with one of the people that is kind of the bad guy in his frame of reference.
He really
hates this person, and I'm not in the business of saying, no, you can't work with us. So this guy now comes to our think tank meetings, and every time he comes, I think, oh, Khalifa is going to haunt me for this. Because Khalifa never let me get away with anything. And that's one of the things I loved about him. And so I'm sure that video disruption was his spirit. Yes?
So, out of curiosity, you know, among the population of labor,
mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't know. I'm not a penologist. You know, I don't know that much. This is not an area that I'm really an expert with. It's something I live. I live with it. I go. And guys that want to get involved with me can. And I don't know about the guys that don't. I would imagine Khalifa is pretty exceptional. But if you have 5,000 lifers in the state of Pennsylvania, there's got to be 500 of them that are amazing. And the thing was, Khalifa would tell you that for the first, am I having a thing here? That for the first 10 to 15 years, it wasn't better. He was still shooting heroin in prison, right? Something clicked at some point. And a lot of these guys will say it's 14, 12 years, 14 years, 16 years. I don't know exactly what it is. But that's 20 years in. That's a guy who's become something else. Right, and we still kept him in prison for another 20-some years. In prison, he was able to do good. And I don't know if you heard about this, but at his funeral, you know, in his eulogy and in the program, it talked about the work he had done with us as like one of the, along with his children, like the thing he was most proud of. So when I first became trained as an instructor to teach Inside Out and to go into prison and do this stuff, I met a guy named James who was, he came up to me in the big prison, Greater Philadelphia. He said, Norm, I'm so glad you're here. I was so excited when I heard you were coming. And I was like, why? You know, who cares if I'm here? Because I'm a juvenile lifer from the north side of Pittsburgh, and I'm someday hoping to get transferred closer to home so I can get involved in some activism. Right? So this is a human being who did something horrible, horrifying, terrible as a child, and will spend the rest of his, at that point, expected to spend the rest of his life in prison. Despite that fact, he wanted to get involved in activism in his community. He was already doing stuff with Inside Out in Philadelphia. If this man is willing to do that, is motivated to do that, if someone like Khalifa is motivated to do that, is willing to do that. If those the other five guys in that picture, all the other guys and women who are participating in this kind of stuff across the state, across the country, and across the world now, if they're willing and able and desperate to do those things, what about you? Which is really a way of saying, what about me, right? What about all of us? How do we not? Who? And it's sort of like ashamed and inspired at the same time. Like, if I don't go out there and do something, who am I? Right? I'm deeply ashamed of myself if I don't. Now, here's the unfair structural advantage that I have. I can make this my job. Right? Because I'm a college professor, I can spend an enormous amount of time doing this kind of stuff and calling it work and advancing my career tremendously in a different direction and farther and better than it ever would have. So in that sense, it's like, well, sure, Norm, but, you know, but for you. But then again, I do have three kids and all the other problems of the world and everything. But I don't know, maybe if you're retired, maybe you have a special structural position to do something. I don't know.
So what's a normal week for you?
I teach 2 days a week. I get there at 8:30 in the morning, probably. I drop my son off at school. I go right there. I teach a couple classes. I try to go to the gym. I teach a couple more classes. I go home. Those are my work days at school. And then the rest of the week, I'm writing. I'm going to prisons. I'm going to the think tank on campus. I'm going to the police academy. I didn't say this exactly, but I kind of did in the thing. But my background is police training. I was sat through the police academy in Cleveland in 1999, 2000. So that's about 20 years on this topic. Right? So when I went and got the inside out training and started doing inside out, I was like, this is the exact opposite of the police academy. The police academy is high school with... I used to say it was high school with guns, but that's not even a joke anymore. But it's terrible. They sit there, they listen to these lectures, they have to get up and stand in the back room to not fall asleep. And it's like, are you kidding me, right? And it's interesting because I was telling Elaine before we got started, I'm in this very weird position where I walk real close between these different worlds. And it's a privilege and it's wonderful, but it's also very, very painful because I've started to take these police recruits into prison to have class with guys like this. The first time we did it, Khalifa was in the class. Right? One thing, I don't know if you heard this story from Michelle. Did Michelle tell the story about his glasses?
I don't know. I was with her child.
Did Michelle tell a story about Khalifa's glasses? There is a woman, because the first time we did this, we had six cops, veteran cops, and the guys from the think tank. And it was a very big deal. The officers all came in their best uniforms, and the command staff of the department was there. And one of the officers, her name was Peg, she comes up with her... Everyone reads something as part of the graduation. And she doesn't have her glasses. So she's here. She runs over there to where Khalifa's sitting and says, Khalifa, quick! Give me those cheaters, which I didn't even know what that meant, the little glasses he wears. And he was like, what? So she just snatched them off his face, put them on, and went up and read the thing. And he's doubled over laughing. You know, this is a man, you know, in his 60s, who at 8 or 9 years old watched the police beat his mother and father. You know, this is a guy that went from foster home, detention center, juvenile facility, right? Watch them beat them in their home. This is a guy who's like, what would you expect if you took an 8? You know, you have grandchildren that are that age, right? What if someone took your grandchild and did all those things to them? Would you expect them to not become drug addicts, to not be engaged in the culture of street crime? So, the fact that this woman did this and Khalifa laughed and they had this relationship was one of the most powerful, amazing, and hilarious moments that almost anyone there had experienced.
Do you see improvements
in
police training?
What I'm doing is no.
I think it is.
It's intended to be. And I've been talking to Elaine about this, like, It's tough because I really love guys in prison, the ones I work with. I really love the cops that I work with. But it may have to be that half the police department has to hate me. And I'm starting to feel the backlash of that. And
why do they hate
you? Because this, what I'm doing is wrong.
Their view is it's wrong.
It's wrong because it's going to make the recruits soft. It's going to get them hurt. X, Y, Z. Hug a thug. It's another example of hug a thug. Right? And then I have friends who are very anti-police. They're saying, your support, you're trying to prop up this broken police culture. That's a mistake. So I'm like, where am I? You know, I don't know, huh? Well, no, you know, I'm going to win. I'm absolutely going to win. You can't, yeah, you're going to make people on both sides angry. And that's probably how you know you're doing the right thing. I mean, because if everyone's happy with it, because policing has been, you know, in this country since, like, the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, right? That's, and the slave patrols in the South. Two things are happening kind of at the same time. Nothing's really changed that much. Let's bring technology in. That's certain things they've done, but fundamentally, policing hasn't changed, and it was never really very good. Structurally, systematically. Not that there aren't good cops, there are great cops. Not that people don't operate in this broken system and still do amazing things. They do. But every few years, there's the new hot topic, hot thing in policing, and that's going to fix everything. And it never does. And they're, oh, it's not like it was 20 years ago, which is what they said 20 years ago. And what they probably said 20 years before that. It's not like it was in the old days. Well, maybe not, but I don't know that it's much better. And the thing is, and I say this to police, I'm concerned, I'm a scholar of policing, I'm a sociologist. I'm concerned with policing from a problems perspective. The problems that police respond to, the problems that police cause, and the problems that police suffer from. Right? And when you explain that to a group that has sort of maybe a prisoner mentality, you're against them. Right? Because you're saying, hey, wait, you're saying we cause problems? Well, I cause problems in my life. I suffer from my problems in my life, and I deal with problems. So I'm not saying you're any worse than me or any other human being, but that triggers them. And I said that one time recently, and a senior command staff level officer said, what that guy did was borderline insubordination. And someone had to explain to this command staff level prisoner that I am not in the chain of command. So I am incapable of, I am not insubordinate to them. Because I'm not subordinate to them.
But you look like you are.
Do I? Maybe undercover. What else?
What got you into this in the first
place? I wanted to be a cop. I so wanted to be a cop when I was a kid. Probably for all the best and worst reasons. I had also been arrested as a kid or a young adult. I went to college. I wanted to do this. I barely graduated from high school. I got arrested the day before commencement. I was like, are they still going to let me graduate? I was like, oh, they just want me out of here. They'll definitely want me to graduate. And I wondered, like, am I always felt like I was in between. Like, basically, it's funny. I'm probably just replicating the same thing where I felt like I'm either going to end up a criminal or a cop. Like, there's no middle path for me. And I went to college, and I started learning about this stuff. And the guy who shot that video was brought in there. He's a war photographer. He's the brother of a guy named Lou Gentile, who was a big-time cop in Pennsylvania. And he was my criminology professor, instructor, whatever, the first semester at 18, after I just got arrested, and now I'm in college. And here's this guy who's like this, he's been undercover in the mafia, and he's done all these things. He's like TV right in front of you. And he's got a gun, you can see it, and a badge. And he, at that time, started, when I'm just this kid, sitting with very short hair, very skinny, and a mustache, sitting in this class, and terrified to say a word because I'm certain that everyone in there is smarter than me. He's up there, he's talking, and we all the young guys and women, we all wanted to be this guy, right? That's when he got a job going into the prison teaching classes, and Khalifa was one of his first students, and he worked with him for 6 years. So there's this weird you know, we're all going to come together at some time. And then after Khalifa died, Lou got involved with our think tank and now comes, and it's amazing. It's, I know that's very much Khalifa's spirit too, because nothing would make him happier than knowing that, because he wants, when we're, there was a lot of anxiety leading up to bringing police in to work with them. Some of them hadn't seen an actual cop in 40 years. Right? They hate the police. But Cleek said, you know, I have a police officer, a cop, who is my friend. I think he's my friend. Right? And it was Lou. So all this stuff kind of folds in and out, and where am I?
Are there other people like you?
Yeah, they're in mental hospitals. They're I'm sure Elaine. Yeah, the Inside Out is a national, worldwide thing now. So there's no one else who's ever done this with police. But part of my work is to say, look, all I'm doing is taking Inside Out and doing it with police. If you can do Inside Out, if you can relate with police and guys in prison, you could do this too. Not everyone can handle, manage both things. So Inside Out was an adjunct faculty member at Temple, right? And the people like Elaine and I are taught to look down on adjunct faculty and don't end up an adjunct faculty person, right? And I've done a lot of adjunct faculty work in my life, so I understand that. So here she is, and here's this guy in prison. They get together. They create this program that's now huge and international and amazing, right? So all I do is come around and say, well, you know, I'm into cops, so I'm going to do this with cops. And someone else says, well, I'm a lawyer and I'm interested in district attorneys, so I'm going to do this with district attorneys. The point is, it's more about the program. So anyone could take this if you can manage the populations and do it. So it's not, you don't have to be, you know, anyone but who you are, you can do it.
And I guess one aspect of this before people get into prison is trying to help level the playing field for children.
Yep. Yeah. That's I've always made it a point not to be involved with children's projects just because I can barely deal with adults. Maybe children are either, I don't know, but our think tank is doing more and more with children, and that's something that's kind of just happening.
Can you talk about that?
Well, one thing is, my wife is doing her dissertation, and I mentioned Leon Ford. Leon Ford is a young man. He was driving from his uncle's house to his grandmother's house on a Sunday. He was pulled over and harassed by these police officers and eventually shot and paralyzed. And he was 19 years old.
I thought he had a stolen car.
Yeah. Well, it's a whole thing that the car was registered to him. It said Leon Ford. It was also registered to his father, which also said Leon Ford. So the thing says Leon Ford twice. In 4 seconds, he hands them all of his proper identification, all says Leon Ford. There was a guy they had known who was involved with gangs and things. His name was Lamont Ford. He was African-American. He was basically the same age. They had the similar hair, these cropped close hair. And they would not believe that this kid was who he was. They kept trying to get him to get out of the car. He didn't want to get out of the car. And there were reasons. I mean, they if it was you, you wouldn't want to get out of the car if the police had said what they had said to him. And eventually, they start pulling him out of the car, which you're not supposed to do. It's a violation of police policy. Another cop jumps into one side, and the car goes forward. No one exactly knows how it went forward, but it did. And the cop shoots him 5 times. You know, as close as anyone sitting next to you, right next to you, know, in the front of a car. And they pull him out of the car, they throw him on the ground, they handcuff him. And police policy procedure is, if you shoot someone, you still administer first aid. They didn't. They let him lay there, and they frantically searched for drugs or guns or something in the car that would justify the shooting. But they couldn't find anything. So then they had to go to the sort of scripted lines. Oh, what did he do? He dragged me. He dragged me. I was being dragged. Remember, like, probably 20 years ago there in Pittsburgh, there was a cop who got dragged and had to shoot into the car to save his life. But that actually happened. So the cop knows he can say that. For him, unfortunately, there's a dash cam video in the car that shows he wasn't dragged. Oh, well, I wasn't dragged, but I was. He was pushing me out of the car, and I was going to fall out of the car. Well, the dash cam video shows that the door was shut. Well, yeah, but he was going to run the other cops over with the car, because a car can always be claimed to be a weapon. Well, but the cops are on, the video shows the cops are on this side of the car, and the car's going forward. Well, he had a bulge in his pants, and that could have been a gun. And this is a young man who has to catheterize himself 6 times a day now.
So what happened?
Nothing. They were promoted. They're detectives now. One quit. He works in private security for PNC. The other two are detectives. There was a trial recently in the fall. There was a big trial, and the city settled for $5.5 million with him, of which the attorneys get like 1.8. The medical bills are 2-something. And remember when you were 19, right? What's the value of from your waist down from then until now in your life? Remembering he is about he may make it to the age of most of you, but his life expectancy is much shorter now. So what would the value of that be for you? Would it be $1 million? $2 million? So.
So is there any progress that you see cops like that being held accountable?
No. No. Well, yes. I mean, I shouldn't say that. It's going to get better. But I sat between my wife and I, we only missed 2 days of that trial, and it went on for weeks. There were 10 jurors. 8 of them voted that he should win, right? 2 of them voted no. That's all it took for him not to win the case, for it to be a hung jury, right? Now, that was a civil case. The criminal case, I forgot that this is an important part. When the police do this kind of thing and make this kind of mistake, if they're unwilling to take responsibility and they want to put it, they have to charge you with attempted murder on 3 police officers. So you're 19 years old, you're laying in a hospital bed, you have a breathing tube, you're told you're paralyzed. A few years earlier, your sister was on a trip or a little with a cheerleading thing and got hit by a car and killed. So your parents have already been through the worst. So the police have to tell you that you're charged, read you your rights. Eventually your mother comes in and the doctor has explained to her that her son is paralyzed. And then you have to go on trial and beat the case to remain free, because otherwise you're going to do time, potentially 20 years, probably even if you got convicted, it wouldn't have been that much, but you're 19-year-old, you're in a prison in a wheelchair. You could say it's better, because 50 years ago, there had never been even maybe a serious investigation. 50 years ago, he would be in prison. 50 years ago, there wouldn't have been a civil trial.
Without the video evidence?
Yeah, the video evidence, Yeah, without the video, it might not have been now, but so you could say that it's unsatisfying, but it is progress. But it's also personally devastating for anyone who cares about these things, Dad.
Would you guess that things like this happen at a greater rate or a lesser rate, or is it just that we're learning? It seems like there's a whole lot more of this happening, particularly with regard to people of color being shot. And sometimes, though, I read that the numbers are not a whole lot different. It's just that we're learning about it.
Well, the only thing different is the video. The only thing different now is we have video of it, and it's changing everything. 20 years ago, when I was in the police academy watching this in Cleveland, I had been watching a show on TV about professional wrestlers being trained and how you could really get reach back and sell your punch and make it look like you're killing this guy. And then in the police academy, the instructor, like the next day, the instructor said, you want to get it real, real short and tight when you hit someone because they could be videotaping it and you don't want it to look bad. That was 20 years ago, so things have changed a lot. We African Americans have been saying from the beginning that it was like that, but sure, they're going to say that's probably not that bad. But the other part of it is, we all have racism inside of us. We all do. So when the police do these things that are bad, that it's obviously bad, they shouldn't have done, it's easier for us, that those of us who consider us progressive, to point at the police. Look at the bad whites. Look at the racism, right? Because we know that's inside of us. And by pointing at them, it's like we can feel a little bit better. Meanwhile, the more conservative or whatever kind of people, they're like, no, no, there is no racism, right? So this the police did the right thing. That kid got shot for having a bad attitude, right? He deserved it. So my thing with police is we ask the police to do something that's impossible. We ask them for effective, efficient crime control and following the Constitution for very little money. They've been talking about that since the 60s, the scholars, right? And then I come along and say, oh, and we ask them, don't be racist when you're doing it, even though you're a product of a racist society. Right? Even though you're from a white family, in a white community, you went to a white school, all of a sudden now we're putting you in an African-American neighborhood where you're seeing people when they're victims or when they're offenders, sort of at the worst moments of their lives. If you take someone who hasn't had normal experience with African-Americans, how are they going to not be racist? How do you even blame them? They signed up to do this thing. So in a way, they made the choice. They're responsible. But on the other hand, we didn't make the choice. We said, let them take care of it for us.
Thank you. That's a beautiful way to end.
Good.
It's as much as you've done.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. This was really, means a lot.